Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
The EPA under this administration treats states like a vessel of federal will.
Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt is Donald Trump's pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency. What impact could he have on environmental regulation here in Massachusetts? Also today, how will Berkshire Street residents rebuild after that 10-alarm fire in East Cambridge?
It's definitely a changing neighborhood and trying to stay true to itself. So we do have a lot of clients in this neighborhood who have lived here for generations and they want to stay here.
And Alexa Young has written for Friends, Sex and the City, and The West Wing. Now she's turning to the stage and is the playwright behind the Victorian thriller Fingersmith, playing at the ART.
Sometimes there's a work of art that you read that stays with you like a friend.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's start with the latest installment of our series examining President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominees and what his pick might mean for Massachusetts. Today, the Environmental Protection Agency. Trump is nominating Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to lead the EPA. Pruitt's official biography on the Oklahoma AG's website says he is, quote, a leading advocate against the EPA's activist agenda. Here's Pruitt testifying before Congress just last year in opposition to the EPA's Clean Power Plan.
The EPA under this administration treats states like a vessel of federal will. The EPA believes states exist to implement the policies the administration sees fit, regardless of whether laws like the Clean Air Act permit such action.
So what might this mean for a state such as Massachusetts? Well, joining us now is Doug Foy. He's founder of the clean tech company Serifix. He's also former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and served as secretary of Commonwealth Development in the administration of former Governor Mitt Romney. Doug Foy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So let me start off with the question I've been asking everyone in this occasional series. How much does it matter at the state level of who runs the federal level, analogous agency? So if you're the Secretary of Environment and Energy in Massachusetts, does it really matter specifically who's at the head of the EPA?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. It matters in that some of the major issues that EPA deals with are of national scope. And so, for instance, air pollution that's transported into Massachusetts from upwind states, back if you think back to the days when we had acid rain problems, EPA is a critical piece of trying to regulate that and bring that into control. On the other hand, there's no doubt that Massachusetts has a lot of firepower to protect itself on all manner of environmental issues, air, water, toxins, solid waste. A lot of the federal programs have, in fact, been delegated to the state for implementation. So the good news is Massachusetts has a lot of power and a lot of ability to protect itself. The troublesome news is to the degree that EPA is weakened or gutted, that will have implications for Massachusetts from sources and pollution that comes from elsewhere.
It's quite a broad scale from weakened to gutted. Do we have any sense from Scott Pruitt's previous criticisms, of which there have been many, including, at least 8 federal lawsuits since 2011 against the EPA, about whether he might weaken or gut the EPA?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell. We, as with any of the president-elect's nominees, we ought to give him the benefit of the doubt and hope for the best. A lot of his statements are very worrisome. He seems to be a climate change denier, questioning whether there even is climate change when all the science is clearly indicating it's a serious, existential problem. He's certainly indicated he opposes a lot of EPA's exercise of its authority. So that is worrisome, and I think we'll have to hope hope for the best and prepare for the worst if need be.
Well, so Doug, let me ask you, I mean, about the climate change part of Pruitt's background here. I mean, what could an EPA administrator do? I mean, could he ostensibly, you know, decide to not use EPA funding for climate research? Could he change EPA's public messaging about climate change? I mean, what impact could his take on climate change have on EPA's role in the public understanding of the, you know, the catastrophe that could come?
Well, a variety of things that could be done if you wanted to try to weaken EPA. You could cut research that is directed at some of these issues relating to climate change. You certainly could stop using the bully pulpit, which EPA has been extremely important to in terms of bringing public awareness to the threats that climate change brings. The irony in Scott Pruitt's case is that states like Oklahoma are going to be disproportionately harmed by the effects of climate change. I mean, you're talking about Dust Bowl droughts for Oklahoma if we don't start dealing with these threats. And so it would be sadly ironic if he was in part responsible for not addressing that issue. On the other hand, there's no doubt that the states are out in front on this anyway. California, Massachusetts, New York, Minnesota, Colorado, there are states all over the country that are actively addressing climate change issues, preparing for its impacts, trying to mitigate its effects. That's not going to change.
Well, do you think, I mean, so we started a little bit earlier with that cut from Mr. Pruitt last year when he was testifying before Congress, where he said the EPA believes states exist to implement the policies as federal administration sees fit, regardless of whether the laws permit such action. So in that case, that was regarding his criticism to the EPA's Clean Power Plan. He was advocating for the primacy of state law over federal regulation. I mean, could that same take work to Massachusetts' advantage if Massachusetts wants to continue to enact state laws that are even more stringent when it comes to environmental regulation than what is coming out of Washington?
Well, there's no doubt that a state has the authority to be tougher. And we always have taken that opportunity in Massachusetts, and other states do the same thing. The federal laws, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the toxics regulation, often set a floor, a sort of a minimum standard that all the nation is supposed to comply with. States can be tougher than that, and indeed have been tougher than that, and Massachusetts is notable for being much more aggressive in protecting its environmental resources. And that will continue, and I'm sure, if anything, might accelerate to the degree the federal government starts to back away from its responsibilities. And the state will also have to pick up some of the enforcement responsibilities that would have otherwise been taken on by EPA. It's worth keeping in mind that most of the federal environmental laws, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the hazardous waste and toxins legislation were bipartisan legislative efforts. They were often adopted in Republican presidential administrations. I think the public is overwhelmingly in favor of clean water, clean air, rivers that don't catch fire, harbors that are clean so you can swim in the water and boat in the water. We're not going to change as a public set of concerns. And to the degree that EPA gets weakened, I expect and would hope that many powers will rise up to resist a reversal on environmental protection.
Powers at the state level? You mean through litigation, activism?
I think there's certainly going to be litigation. I think the state, the Attorney General in Massachusetts, the state agencies, the advocacy groups, Conservation Law Foundation that I used to head, and a bunch of others, are certainly going to enforce the laws. I would be astounded, astounded if this Congress chose to either repeal or weaken the major federal laws that protect the environment. The public would be outraged by that. So that I would be really surprising. I think.
But Doug, if I could just jump in here, maybe you were about to get to the point that I wanted to underscore. you know, perhaps Congress isn't going to take action to undo laws at the federal level, but, you know, an EPA administrator can weaken the agency itself. I mean, we were looking at the fact that Ronald Reagan's first EPA chief, Ann Gorsuch, basically cut its budget the first year she was in office by almost 25%, and enforcement cases from regional EPA offices fell by almost 80% during her first year.
Yes. And then she was eventually driven from office. And she was driven from office, one, because the public rose up and said, this is not acceptable. We don't want to go backwards on environmental protection. And interestingly, the other folks that rose up was industry. Industry wants consistent environmental regulation, and they want it applied even-handedly. The good companies, and most of them are good, are trying to not be polluters. And they don't want to have competitors get away with polluting. So there was an enormous uprising, upwelling of complaint as EPA started to weaken in the Gorsuch era from industry saying, because two things happened. One, the bad guys started get away with being able to do bad things, and that really was not anti-competitive. And also the states stepped up, and you started to get a multitude of regulatory burdens on industry rather than a single clear standard. I mean, Massachusetts and California are not going to stop caring about environmental protection, and they're not going to stop regulating the things that matter. If you're the auto industry, you do not want to have to produce 50 different versions of a Ford Fusion because you have 50 different states regulating air quality issues.
So Doug, let me ask you, though. I take your point about industry writ large, but I think, as you well know, what a lot of people focus on regarding Scott Pruitt are his ties particularly to the oil and gas industries. We were looking at a 2014 investigation by the New York Times that happened to win the Pulitzer Prize that focused on a letter that Scott Pruitt sent to the EPA arguing that regulators were overestimating the amount of air pollution caused by energy companies that were drilling in Oklahoma. And that letter happened to be written by lawyers for one of the state's biggest oil and gas companies. It was given to Pruitt by the company's lobbyist. His office made only a couple word changes and then sent it to the EPA.
Yes. Well, I think we have reason to be concerned. That was a clear indication of Mr. Pruitt's bias toward oil and gas. He's also been fairly outspoken about trying to restore the coal industry. There's no way the coal industry is coming back in this country. It was killed by the gas industry because we have a proliferation in gas. It's a much cleaner fuel than coal. But yes, there's no doubt that the regulation of the oil and gas industry, both in terms of emissions and water pollution and all the other toxins that come out of that industry, would be and is of great concern because EPA is on the front lines on that. And there's very little that Massachusetts can do to protect itself against some of those problems that would happen in other states if EPA gives up the fight.
Well, Doug Foy is founder of the clean tech company Serifix. He's also former president of the Conservation Law Foundation and served as Secretary of Commonwealth Development in the administration of former Governor Mitt Romney. Doug, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Omega.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Cambridge City officials say they've dispersed more than $87,000 in aid to some of the 125 people displaced by this weekend's 10-alarm fire in East Cambridge. The mayor's relief fund has raised more than $575,000 so far. That immediate cash aid is just the first step in the long rebuilding process faced by Berkshire Street residents. We visited the neighborhood yesterday and saw blackened, condemned buildings ruined by the fire. So we're on the corner of Berkshire and Plymouth Street, and from this side we can see really the extent of the damage to St. Patrick's Place, this church that was converted into 16 units of affordable housing. The windows are all blasted out. The roof is totally collapsed. Wet. You can see incinerated roof beams and rafters. It's blackened. The building is clearly destroyed. But crews are hard at work. A trio of trucks from the Cambridge Electrical Department rumble by us. Workers for Verizon use bucket trucks to attend to sagging phone lines, and they raise fresh new wood telephone poles to brace the ones charred by the fire. So there's absolutely no doubt that this neighborhood will bounce back. But what will it look like when it does? Real estate values in East Cambridge are rapidly rising, and many of the families displaced by the fire were living in affordable housing. So we met up with Deborah Rue. She's executive director of Just a Start, the Cambridge Community Development Corporation that owns St. Patrick's Place, that fire-gutted church we were looking at that Just a Start had converted into housing units. The entire development includes several buildings totaling some 32 units. And I asked Deborah Rue how much of St. Patrick's Place had been damaged and whether Cambridge families risked losing this gem of affordable housing on Berkshire Street.
The fire impacted the roof, and there's a tremendous amount of water damage.
Yeah.
The basement has parking for 13 cars.
Uh-huh.
I understand the water's so high some of the cars are floating. You know, that's kind of the most damaged of our properties. But to the right are three buildings that are more like triple deckers. One of them is 40 York Street. Is also sustained some damage, but we definitely will be able to repair that. It may take a couple of months to get it done, and then two more are actually okay.
How many families and people lived in St. Patrick's Place?
There are 16 units. 15 of them were occupied. In the total campus here, there's 32 units. 16 in the original church building alone.
Okay, and 30 of them were affordable housing, right?
32, all of them were affordable housing.
All of them were affordable housing. So how much of a loss is it for Just to Start? I mean, obviously, it's a total loss for the families who are living
right,
here.
Right, right. It's a total loss. And all of the families that are of those 16 units need to find other permanent housing. And we're working with them, and as the city is working with them extensively to get them into other affordable housing. Just to Start, has a portfolio of about 600 units in Cambridge, and we have a handful that are available, and we're trying to get those folks into those as a priority. As other agencies have come forward, and you know, the market rate housers have come forward too, but they're of course wanting market rates. So it's a big challenge, because the other desire is to keep people in this neighborhood or to keep them in Cambridge.
Yeah.
In the neighborhood particularly, which is even more challenging because a lot of people have kids in the schools and, you know, they don't want to move their kids to other schools.
So can you tell me the story about how St. Patrick's Place was developed from, obviously it was a church beforehand,
right,
into all of these units of affordable housing?
Right. Yeah. In 1991, the Archdiocese decided to close St. Patrick's and wanted somebody to take the property. And Just to Start worked with the Cambridge Community Development Corporation and neighborhood associations, etc., to actually acquire that and put together the financial package. Our records show that it cost about $4 million to renovate.
So $4 million in the 90s?
In the 90s.
Okay.
Right, right. Yeah. So, of course, redeveloping this will be significant.
I mean, so it's a huge consideration. So do you know for sure that Just to Start will be able to hold on to this property? I mean,
We will definitely be able to hold on to it. I think it's a matter of what happens to the structure itself and how we have to redevelop it. And even if it could be restored, I'm sure it would have to, you know, need extensive work.
Yeah.
That will take years.
Because one of the reasons why we wanted to talk with you is that one concern that we were wondering about is if the gentrification pressures right around the neighborhood could end up changing the fabric of Berkshire Street.
That's already really started to happen. And what the building next door that initially allegedly caught on fire, I mean, I just read in the Globe, sold for $1.5 million and was being gutted. So that is no longer in the affordable stock, because if they're making three units and they're putting in, you know, they're going to sell for $750,000 or $800,000 or more, you know, that is gentrification. I mean, and one of the great things that you actually see, you know, both, you know, it has a double-edged sword, but one of the great things you see in Cambridge oftentimes is affordable housing, because it's done in a quality way, right next door to, you know, market-rate housing. So, you know, this will be maintained as affordable housing. There is really no risk of us, you know, losing this.
Right. And that's because Justice Starr owns it, though.
Yes.
I'm wondering, we can't know yet, but there are individual property owners here who also lost their
absolutely.
Homes. What might happen there?
And what
right?
will happen to those? I mean, that will be, you know, Cambridge real estate is at an absolute premium. How it'll impact the long-term neighborhood. I mean, we've already seen kind of the pressure of Kendall Square kind of moving in here on East Cambridge. So it'll have an impact.
So what are the immediate challenges that Justice Starr faces?
Well, do you have all day? The immediate challenges really are, I think, twofold. There's the building and what's going to happen with it, and there's the residents. So the major focus right now, we've been spending countless hours and hours and hours, is with residents and trying to help them get into other housing. We have, you know...
Where are they now?
Mostly they're in the Holiday Inn in Somerville, the ones that needed to be put up. We don't have insurance for that. That is something that, you know, we either have to fund or the city is going to fund with the money that they raised, or we're going to get more funds to help with that. So the biggest challenges are helping the residents and getting them housed appropriately in places where they can afford and have transportation and all the issues. And then there's the building, and the one building that can be renovated pretty quickly in a couple months is a priority, and then figuring out what to do with this. And people have belongings in there, and they're all really wanting to get in. And, you know, we have to determine the safety before we can let anyone in there.
You used to live in this neighborhood. How much has it, how much has it changed since you...
Well, you know, I lived in this neighborhood 40 or so years ago. I'd say a lot of it looks and feels the same way. I mean, we have trendier restaurants, but you still have some of those shops. There's that live poultry sign that was here when I lived here, and I hope never goes away because it's kind of an icon. So it's definitely a changing neighborhood and trying to stay true to itself. So we do have a lot of clients in this neighborhood who have lived here. You know, they've been in the families for generations, and they've lived here, and they want to stay here.
Well, thank you so much
for
talking with us. We wish you the best of luck in getting people back into housing.
Yeah.
And, we'll put links on our website to just to start to get people, see if they want to help you out, too.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. Take care.
Well, that's Deborah Rue. She's executive director of Just a Start, the Cambridge Community Development Group that owns several affordable housing units that were damaged in the East Cambridge fire. We met her yesterday on Berkshire Street. And by the way, we will have those links at our website that I was talking about. The website is radioboston.org. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Sarah Waters' novel, Fingersmith, has all the hallmarks of a classic thriller set in the Victorian era. There's a pickpocket, a con man, and a ploy to cheat a young heiress out of her fortune. But as is slowly revealed, not everything is what it seems. Fingersmith was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2002, and now it's been faithfully adapted into a new play for the American Repertory Theater. The show generally follows an orphan pickpocket, a fingersmith who poses as a maid to gain the trust of a wealthy heiress, and her job is to persuade the heiress to elope with a con man who plans to swindle her of her fortune. But again, I have to say, not everything is as it seems. And it's playwright Alexa Young who put Fingersmith on stage. She's also an Emmy-nominated television writer who's worked on shows such as Friends, Sex and the City, and The West Wing. And Alexa Young joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, there are a lot of twists and turns in Fingersmith, and we don't want to give them away. But do you think I gave you a fair sort of plot summary as to what happens here?
Yes, that was very enticing.
So it's set in the Victorian era. Now, what is it about Fingersmith, the novel, first of all, that captivated you so much?
Well, it's incredibly vivid, and you know, it's kind of almost like watching a movie to read it. But I think I was really captivated by the characters first and foremost, and the fact that it's kind of a ripping yarn that sneaks up on you because it's actually quite political and has a lot to say about women and women's roles. So I think the kind of cumulative party pack of great things happening was extremely compelling. And by the time I finished it, I was already imagining, you know, trying to put these characters on a stage.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a second, because I think when people heard me introduce sort of the rough outline of the plot here and they hear the words orphan pickpocket, right? a Dickensian young boy probably comes to mind, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Yeah, that's right. Sarah Waters, I don't know, for those who, there are many who know and love her work. She's a beloved treasure in England, and many, many, many devoted fans here. But one of the things that she's doing and she's interested in kind of the fiction writing that she does is reclaiming roles for women in a way that is kind of contemporary, in that we're seeing women be aggressive and assertive and being in the center stage of a work where traditionally, if it were Dickens, they might not be. But she's interested in creating a fiction where women are kind of being activated in that way, and yet it feels extremely faithful to the kind of work that was done at that time. So you could imagine this book, you know, alongside many other Dickens books, or, you know, Wilkie, or any of those kinds of classics from the time. So it's a sort of neo-Victorian way of getting into all of it, but yet I think she's, because it's such a Valentine to a great story, you find yourself completely sort of seduced and consumed by the action.
Yeah, I mean, you've called the novel beforehand a Valentine to the Gothic thriller, domestic drama, and Victorian sensation novel.
Yeah.
I mean, have you always been a fan of this genre and the stories that come out or are set in that, in the, you know, the mid to late 19th century in England?
I am. I think that I have always sort of had an anachronistic love of and kind of yearning towards this time, just generally, even probably when I was a kid. But yeah, I did my sort of my thesis for college on a short story called The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, which is sort of in the same area. It's a little bit spooky, but it's sort of about feminists and the sort of oppression of that. That's about a lot about hysteria and the way that women were sort of, you know, said to be crazy or hysterical and, you know, put into places to take care of them when they were just being sort of, you know, tortured by the patriarchy. So.
I mean, what do you think it is about this particular time period and Victorian writing that seems to so continuously captivate us? You're not the only one. I mean, there's something about stories set in the soot-blackened back alleys of London in, you know, 1880 that still seem to speak to us in 2016.
I think that people are really compelled by the class issues.
Yeah.
I think that that really is something that, you know, we often identify with the sort of Victorian hero because they're scrappy and they're, you know, it's about sort of, you know, the sort of take down the king mentality. And I think that's instantly, for me, that really hooks you into wanting these characters to be successful, but being willing to go on whatever ride they need to go on. And, mm-hmm. and they don't need to be, you know, red, yellow, and blue in terms of like villains and, you know, heroes. And that's one of the things I love about Sarah Waters' work, is that she's using Dickensian, like, you know, one of the characters' name is Mrs. Suxby, and she's a baby farmer. So there's a kind of awareness that there's a Dickensian kind of labeling going on, and yet they can be more than one thing at a time.
Yeah. But just to return to a point you were making earlier, I mean, Dickens did an exquisite job in talking about the social and class structures of Victorian England as it largely applied to the lives of men.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so compelling to both, you know, read Fingersmith the novel and see it on stage, because what we don't read all that often in literature is how it affected the lives of women And here the heart of the play and the novel is centered around three women, right?
That's right. And and none of them have agency. They are all sort of relegated to certain roles that, you know, if they don't sort of, one of the characters says, you know, we'll never get what we're due if we don't take it for ourselves. And I think that, you know, I find that relevant in terms of contemporary culture in some ways, especially these days for me. But at the same time, you know, it didn't matter whether you were a high class woman. One of the characters in the play is she's very wealthy, but is imprisoned by her uncle and literally not allowed to like go outside or, you know, use money, or she's never learned to ride a horse, and, you know, is very much stuck, you know, physically and mentally and spiritually in this house, you know, off in the country. And then there are these sort of scrappy thieves that are doing the best they can. But there's definitely a sense that, you know, their lives are so hard, so life and death in a way that we take for granted in a contemporary way. Like, you know, it's very normal that people are dying from illness every day of the week. And so there's a kind of, I've tried to capitalize on that as to find ways to make that humorous, in that it's like what their normal is so shocking to us, but they're able to laugh at it and kind of see it as just daily life. Yeah. So
let's talk a little bit about, if we could, the sort of the technical challenges of putting a novel like Fingersmith on stage. Even at a place as that has virtuoso capabilities like the ART, it started out as a 580 plus page book.
Yes, and
how do you convert that into a play?
It was an incredibly delicious task, and there was a period where I thought, I can't do this. I got to quit. Like, this is just too hard. And I actually flew up to Oregon, where they had commissioned it at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And I told everybody I couldn't do it, and we should just tell Sarah Waters it wasn't happening. And thankfully, they said, okay, well, we'll see you in 2 weeks for the reading, and paid no attention to me. So I appreciated that. But, you know, it's really about figuring out what action you want to be, what is the story that you want to tell. And, you know, thankfully, this had a real beginning, middle, and end that I could follow and kind of trace the path. And then it's about what action, you know, how to condense the action, and, you know, hard decisions about things to get rid of that, you know, are really compelling. And at one point I also called them up and said, would you consider making this a two-night affair with, you know, like a sort of Nicholas Nickleby? And everybody's heads exploded. I could hear it on the other end of the phone. But I think it's about like really defining what the journey of the women at the center is going to be, and then making sure that the action services that and is kind of, I'm being faithful to the emotional story, as much as I would love to include so many of the other characters that are in the book and wonderful sequences.
Yeah. Has Sarah Waters seen it? She must have seen it.
So, yeah. She came out to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and was there opening night, and she's just delightful. She has been reading drafts as we've gone along. And, you know, she's a PhD in Victorian literature. So I think she's, you know, very aware of, the sort of the importance of historical accuracy, although she also uses anachronism to kind of make the piece feel real in a way. But she was so supportive, and she actually said, we were on a panel together, and she admitted that when I had first approached her about the rights, she was a little bit nervous about it. And she said she just couldn't figure out why an American would want to adapt such a, really sort of, you know, British subject and novel. And then it sort of evolved a little bit. And she said, you know, honestly, I was worried about what the accents would sound like, because, you know, it's hard sometimes for us to hear the Americans doing, you know, these dialects.
Did you tell her we feel likewise when British actors try to do American accents?
Yes. I did not bring that up. But she sort of trumped me, because she said, I have three words for you. Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, yes. And the world's worst English accent in Mary Poppins.
Right. Yeah. So I guess that's traumatized the entire...
Well, before I let you go, just briefly, I mean, in the introduction, I reminded folks that you've written for television as well, for Friends, Sex and the City, The West Wing. We just got a couple seconds here, but How does that differ from trying to put a story like Fingersmith on stage?
Well, this particular story, because there is so much plot and so much story that a lot of the story breaking skills that I have been useful, but it's been inspiring to be able to lift it up and work on something that's three dimensional in this way.
Well, Alexa Young is the playwright of Fingersmith. It's playing now through January 8th of 2017 at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. She's also a multiple Emmy and WGA award nominee. And by the way, we've got more information about the ART's production at our website, radioboston.org. Alexa Young, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful.